Do you go through the jhanas in reverse order to come out? It can be helpful to learn them forwards and reverse. So when people are learning, I'll encourage them to go 1, 2, 1, and then 1, 2, 3, 2, 1, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 3, 2, 1, and 1, 2, 3, 2, 3, 4, 3, 4, 3, 2, 3, 2, 1, 2, yeah. So you can play with that. But if you're going to do insight practice, usually the best thing to do is go to the highest number you know, 4 in this case, and then just start doing your insight practice. So if your insight practice is a body scan, you would be in the fourth jhana focused on quiet stillness, and then you put your attention at the top of your head and do the body scan. You don't have to make the jhana go away, it'll fade out. If your insight practice is choiceless awareness, you're in the fourth jhana, everything is real cocooned, and then you just open up your attention and just be aware of, you know, whatever comes into view. If you're doing Mahasi method, yeah, open up and just start noticing what you're noticing and note it. So you don't have to go backwards. You just start doing the practice. You don't even make the jhana go away. It'll fade out. If you haven't heard that you start sinking down, it can be scary, although there's nothing scary about it. The only thing that's scary is, what's happening to me? All right. It actually, once you get used to it, you've done it a few times, it's like, oh, cool, it's really going to get quiet now. And it's actually a very pleasant feeling. Yeah.
You talked about how time is distorted when you're in those states. How do you then figure out how long you're going to stay in it and when to come out?
Yeah, so time is distorted. How do you figure out how long you've been in and how long you want to stay in? Yeah, you just estimate. It's going to be sloppy. It's not going to be particularly accurate. But as you get more skilled, you'll start finding that you have a much better sense of how long you've been in there. At one point, after I'd gotten quite skilled with the eight jhanas, I used to go to James Barris's Thursday night meditation class, which met in a Chan temple in Berkeley, Chinese Zen. And they have a very elaborate altar. And there was a tiny clock on the altar. And I would sit down, and 25 minutes later, I had gotten to access and through all eight jhanas. And then I was doing an open eye meditation as my insight practice. And I'd open my eyes, and every week it was around 25 minutes. I just had a feel for how long I wanted to be in there. It was a 45-minute sit. I wanted to spend about half of it concentration, half of it on insight practice. And so that's what I was getting pretty much every week because I had done it enough, I got a sense. But yeah, sometimes you're in there and the bell rings and it was like, wait, they can't be ringing the bell this soon. And other times you're in there and you get down to 4 and I'm going to stay here till the bell rings. And it seems like a long time till the bell rings. So yeah, you just have to play with it and see. You're not going to be accurate to start with, but over time, yeah, it'll get more and more accurate.
You said that the body awareness disappears in the different type of the jhanas.
In the Visuddhimagga jhanas, there's no body awareness, right?
So this is not, and none of these are like that one.
Yeah, this is all the suttas. Okay. So the suttas, the discourses of the Buddha, 2,500 years old. The Visuddhimagga is 5th century, so 1,500 years old. So yeah. 800, 900 years in between. Yeah.
For people like me or people like us that aren't on, I'm not going on any long retreats anytime soon. I'd like to, but I don't think so just now. So then, would it be the ideal, and we're not going to be kind of done here, obviously, and then at home would be quite difficult as well. So would the idea just be to get to access if you can and then hang out there and then at some point find a longer retreat with somebody who knows about them and then that's most realistic?
That's pretty good. What I would say is, it's difficult to learn the jhanas at home. I mean, people do occasionally. But generally, they have really good daily practice, like, you know, 3 or 4 hours a day. And so if you don't have time to go on a retreat, you probably don't have time for 3 or 4 hours a day. But some people do learn them at home. But otherwise, what I would say is spend half of your meditation period concentrating your mind, and then half doing some sort of insight practice, rather than just trying to work with concentration. Get what concentration you can. And again, you're estimating what's halfway. So some sits, maybe you're doing concentration most of the time, and other times you sit down and it's like, no, this is really bad. It's not going to get concentrated, and you just, you know, have to deal with what's coming up. But sort of you're hoping for about 50-50 concentration, 50 insight. And then at some future time, yeah, go on a retreat and see what you can do. The practicing getting to access concentration is going to serve you really well when you go on a retreat where you're going to work on deeper concentration. Most people on the retreats I teach get to access concentration. But if you already come in knowing how to do that, you're ahead of the game. So, yeah, you get what concentration you can, and then don't neglect doing some insight practice as well.
And so would it be within one session, you'd recommend within one session, half and half?
Within one session, half and half.
Okay, so it wouldn't be an idea to half-hour sit.
It's like you're starting a fire by rubbing sticks together. So you rub real hard. I'm tired. I'm going to take a break here. No. When you start rubbing again, it's all gone. So if you work on the concentration really hard and you don't do any insight practice, yeah, that didn't help a lot. Even if you do insight practice, you know, the next day, your concentration's long gone. Even if you do insight practice an hour later, if you do it immediately thereafter, yeah, good. It's still hot. So, yeah, in the same city.
So, following on from what our friend over there said, to some extent, do you think that the jhanas are for everyone? Particularly, there doesn't seem to be very much opportunity in Britain to learn systematically with a teacher. Or do you think there's some for whom it appeals and it's a good way for them to practice? And I knew virtually nothing about it till I came to hear you talk today. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether anyone else shares this reaction, but I feel scared about what I've heard. I feel I don't want to go there. I feel really alarmed about the idea of deliberately altering my consciousness. I just want to stay where I know I am.
Mm-hmm.
So
if you were to go on a jhana retreat scared like that, you probably wouldn't experience any jhanas. Yeah, I mean, no, they're not for everyone. They're for people who have a skill in concentration and want to learn to use that skill in concentration on the spiritual path and aren't worried about altering their consciousness. The one thing I would say about being afraid of these states, if they were dangerous, I'd be dead by now. I've been doing this for 28 years, and my life is a lot better than it was 28 years ago. Furthermore, the Buddha recommends it all over the place, and he was trying to get rid of dukkha, so he was pretty much doing a good job. But yeah, you're not the first person I've encountered that found it just a little too weird. And wasn't interested. If you're not interested, there are lots of other practices to do. I would say the jhanas are for people who have skill at concentration and want to use that concentration on the path. Now, skill at concentration. I couldn't tell you the number of people that they come to their first interview on a retreat with me and they go, I don't know what I'm doing on a jhana retreat. I'm not any good at concentration. And they, by the time of their third interview, they've got all four jhanas going. So, remember, concentration isn't that furrowed brow tightness. It's indistractability. It's the ability to let your mind really settle. So to find out, do you have the skill for the jhanas, you sort of got to try it out on a retreat. But yeah, if it's frightening, yeah, forget it. Don't worry about it. It's not necessary to get to the jhanas to make astoundingly beneficial progress on the spiritual path. I don't know if you could get all the way to awakening without the jhanas. I can find enough passages in the suttas to prove that you do need the jhanas, and enough passages to prove you don't need the jhanas. Okay, so I think anyone who says definitively one way or the other probably is only reading some of the passages. We need a lot more fully awakened people and find out how they got there to get an answer to this. So please, please get busy.
Do you think it's part of
the
evolution of the you were talking about British culture earlier on? Do you think it's partly that there's this British feeling about happiness? You have to earn it. You have to pay for it. Don't actually cultivate it. There's something very un-British about it.
Yes. Yes. Unfortunately, it does vary from culture to culture. Yeah, the British are a bit more reserved. And it's actually a bit... I wouldn't say it's a bit harder for British people to learn the jhanas, but I would say that the percentage is not quite as high as, say, someone from Italy or Spain, where it's like, get into your emotions. And they're like, oh, sure, we can do that. Right. So there is a cultural difference here. It's been very interesting teaching. I've taught retreats in the U.S., Britain, Sweden, Finland, Germany, Portugal. I've had students from Spain, Italy, Turkey, Israel. I taught a retreat in Israel. The Mediterranean cultures do better than anybody else. So, there is a cultural difference there. But this last retreat I taught at Gaia House, there were plenty of people getting into the jhanas. So it's a small difference on a large scale. Is there another question over here?
Well, I was just going to add to this thing about being afraid of it, and I wonder if it's, or I don't know. I just find that what you're describing comes up in my meditation anyway.
Yeah, it does.
It's not alien to me what you're saying, even though I've never especially studied the jhanas, although I have had Rob Verbey as my teacher often, and it's probably just how he teaches, although I've never done a jhana retreat.
Yeah. What you describe is not uncommon at all. I get people every retreat to come to their interview and say, yeah, that happens to me.
Yeah.
But they don't get everybody coming to that. But there's certainly a significant minority every single retreat of people who've been falling into these states.
And I particularly relate to the smiling and the laughing, because I actually find myself laughing sometimes. Mm-hmm. So the happiness kind of pervades...
Right.
All on its own.
Yeah. Yeah, this
I'm not a particularly happy person. I know, it's not because I'm wonderfully happy, generally.
Yeah, this is where the mind likes to go.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that... I really am just a hippie computer programmer. The fact that I can teach this to people isn't because I'm a great teacher. It's because you have a human mind, and the human mind likes to go this way. If you get some instructions to go in this direction... Yeah, this is what shows up. Yeah. The jhanas weren't invented. They were discovered. It appears that people had been doing mindfulness of breathing for 1,000 years before the Buddha came along. So I'm guessing for 950 years they've been stumbling into these states, if not longer. I stumbled into the first jhana on my second retreat. It's not that alien. And people that have been doing a lot of practice, they fall into these states. And it's actually it's quite useful to fall into the states, because whether you intended it or not, you've got a very good concentration and your insight practice is going to go better. Even if you just stay in these states and then get up, not continue formal insight practice, but remain mindful, you're going to have better results than you will if you just get up from not being concentrated. Furthermore, neuroscience has found that our brains are fairly malleable. There's neurological plasticity. And that whatever mental states you have a tendency to hang out in, those are the states that are most likely to show up. And furthermore, you can move your emotional set point from sort of negative to sort of positive simply by spending more time in positive states. So if you're saying you're not a particularly happy person, but you spend time hanging out in happy states, it will make you happier in the long run. Yeah. So, yeah, it's useful stuff, and people do find them on their own. And, yeah, so hopefully what I'm saying, it gives them a sense of what's happening and how they can use it.
You mentioned, I think it was in relation to the third or fourth state, insight about the body, about touching, pressure, something like that. What did you discover about the body through the journey that you wouldn't have discovered without them?
I don't remember what I said. I would say the jhanas didn't really bring that much body knowledge. The body is so far in the background. I can drink, steep, saturate, and suffuse it. But, yeah, there's not a lot of bodily investigation going there, and I don't remember what I said that... In the Satipatthana Sutta, which we would do post-jhana, there's mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of vedana, of the mind, of phenomena. So, yeah, I learned quite a lot about my body doing insight practice, particularly post-jhana. The body scan was very, very helpful. When I left that first retreat with Ayakema, that was my main practice, was doing a body scan, which was very helpful for helping me be more embodied. The first 27 years of my life, my body was the method I used to transport my head from place to place. Okay? And then, you know, it was getting better that I was entering it at times, but then the body scan was very helpful. But that was insight practice rather than concentration.
After 15 years I've been practicing now, and it's like I'm still learning just basic meditation. And same thing happened last year, happened this year, just sitting by the beach watching the waves come in. How much I noticed that each wave that trickles in or trickles out, there are no two waves the same. And it's made me really contemplate the breath in the same way and realize that actually there are no two breaths the same, just like we're taught. And it's really helped my concentration, having that experience. And just by sitting by the sea and coming into the present moment as well, just by watching waves. And so it's led me to realize that there is this unbelievably fine line, if there is one at all, between doing the breath and being with the breath.
Yeah, you don't want to do the breath. Yeah. You want to just observe the breath.
And I've noticed that in my meditations, like, I seem to be concentrated, but it's very in, out, and actually each breath is actually pretty much the same, which has made me realize I'm doing the breath. And as I really step back from that and observe, it's a completely different... Mm-hmm. So it's like, really, like, unconsciously just being mechanical rather than, you know. So you've already clarified it. So to go into concentrated states, the jhanas, it really is about being in the moment with each breath just as it happens.
Exactly. Yeah. If you control the breath, you won't get the concentration necessary for the jhanas. Yeah. Meditation is about observation. Okay. There's nothing to do except point your attention somewhere. At the breath, or on the feeling of metta, or throughout the body as you're doing your body scan. Yeah, so it's all about observing rather than doing. Yeah, I mean, they call us human beings, but in this culture, it's all human doings. Right? So we got to go back to being human beings.
Yeah, that's really helpful.
Yeah.
The other thing I keep doing, I notice I can be quiet very easily, but it's not that thoughts come and go. I keep interjecting them.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know, they don't come and go. I actually am protecting myself from being quiet by interjecting. I really see that.
Yeah, I know that one well. Yeah, it's just how we're programmed. And so it's really about, yeah, letting the mind come to rest on something so that the thoughts just sort of don't come in and disturb you. Yeah.
It's been really helpful. Thank you.
Good.
I forgot your name, Ron.
Catherine.
Oh, Catherine, we've known each other for years.
Yes.
Yeah, I know about that one.
I found what you said very helpful. Tell you why, because somebody asked me today, you know, just sort of here, do you know what this jhana is about? I said, look, I was introduced to meditation 40 years ago. I'm not sure I know what's going on here.
Yeah.
but there's I wonder now if I'm familiar with what you're talking about without even admitting that I actually know it. Because the mind, it has all that. And there's one big experience somewhere that everybody is having except me.
No. Yeah.
But I've had little glimpses of things that you're talking about that seems to, you know, and you use the word observation. That was a teacher I'm very fond of. He's dead now. He said, if you don't understand anything that I'm talking about, just observe. Observe everything. Observe something beautiful, you know, even observe a piece of excrement on the pavement.
Right.
Just observe.
Yeah, that's brilliant advice. What we've got to do is see the world as it is. And the only way you're going to see the world as it is observe. And so if you do everything but observe, you're going to make zero progress. If you only observe, you'll make progress. If you observe with a very concentrated mind, you'll make faster progress. But yeah, I'm not surprised. If you've been meditating for 40 years, yeah, you stumble into these states. As I said, yeah, a significant minority of students, every retreat comes in saying, yeah, I've been here before. Yeah, so.
There was actually somebody in Gaia House who was having her first retreat. Towards the end, she says, I've just discovered that I have been meditating before.
Yeah.
I've been meditating all my life and I didn't even know it.
Right, yeah. There's this tendency to realize the cultural thing of busy all the time, maybe not the best thing. And that getting in touch with the quiet, just paying attention with nothing as a goal, it can be very helpful. Yeah. Okay, last two, and then we're going to take a break.
Yeah, just an observation. I broke my wrist yesterday, and I noticed that whenever I put a story onto the breaking of the wrist, oh, I won't be able to do this, oh, this will happen, oh, what will I do, my hand will be deformed, the pain would intensify.
Right.
As soon as I said, well, it's a broken wrist, you know, they'll deal with it in the hospital, you know, just a crack, you know, whatever, the pain would go down.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of our pain actually is in the mind.
Yes, this is exactly what the Buddha was teaching. There's a beautiful sutta. He says that an uninstructed worldling, that's how it's usually translated. Santikaro translated as a thickster, someone who's thick-headed. So an uninstructed worldling gets shot with one arrow, breaking the wrist, and then immediately shoots themselves with a second arrow. Poor me, this is horrible, I'm not going to be able to do. And is suffering the pain of two arrows. An awakened one gets shot with one arrow, breaks the wrist, doesn't shoot themselves with a second arrow. He couldn't solve the physical dukkha that we experience. I mean, he got old, sick, and died, right? But it didn't upset him. And so, yeah, if you don't shoot yourself with a second arrow, it's much less painful. So, yeah, you've created a perfect example for yourself of this particular sutta. Yeah, but good luck with your wrist.
So the idea is to, when you get the first arrow, just observe it.
Right. Yeah.
I was just wondering, with the notes that you was reading there, whether it's possible to download them.
Yes, you can download that whole sutta. There's a wonderful website called Sutta Central. Okay? SuttaCentral.net. And they have a huge number of suttas there. I don't know how many. There's 10,000 suttas. They've probably got over 1,000. All right? Some of which are hosted there and some of which they're pointing to other places that have them hosted. If you go to Sutta Central and you click on suttas, because they have also the Chinese agamas and the Sanskrit versions, I mean, it's really amazing. So click on suttas, then click on Digha Nikaya, which is the long discourses. And then you click on the second of the long discourses on the little EN in the right-hand column. Okay, it's not real obvious. If you put your mouse on it and it says translated by Bhikkhu Bodhi, then you have exactly what I have. Because what I did was I took Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation and converted it into a Kindle book so I could have it on my Kindle. All right, so it's the exact same stuff that's there. So it's the EN that's not in italics in the right-hand column of the second line where it says Samanyapala Sutta. And Sutta Central has lots and lots of insights. If you have a Windows computer, you can go to my website, and then you can download a program I wrote for Windows, and then you can download a database of 2,000 suttas that I have and put it on your Windows computer. Okay, and that's under Sutta Database on my website. And my website is my first name, L-E-I-G-H, and my last initial, B.com, Libby.com. Okay, so we're going to take a short break. It's 40 minutes past 3, 10 minutes, and then when we come back, I'll talk about the higher jhanas. And that should get us probably very close to the end of the day. So, okay, so short break. There won't be a bell.